test and trace has been the mantra. But here in the UK, it was started, then abandoned as the number of cases rose too high to manage. It's now being reintroduced, and we're all being encouraged to download the NHS COVID-19 phone app, which can detect whether you've been near an infected person using Bluetooth technology. How have other countries around the world been managing to test and trace COVID patients? And what lessons can we learn from them? Professor Michael Hopkins at the Science Policy and Research Unit, University of Sussex, is an author of a paper where an international team analysed and compared national testing systems in six countries, that's Spain, South Korea, South Africa, Ireland, Germany and us, in June, July and August. And he told Marley Chesterton that we all have something to learn.
We were interested to look at some countries where clearly there was a high level of preparedness and quite a sophisticated response. So I'm talking there about Germany and South Korea. We wanted to include Spain because they had a very high level of cases, and Ireland obviously also very close to the UK physically, and South Africa, a country which we expected to have quite a well-developed response with the resources that they already had in place for contact tracing with other diseases such as TB and HIV.
This is a huge undertaking, Michael, because, I mean, if you just wanted to go through the UK and look at how we've dealt with this coronavirus, that's a lot of work. You're doing that for six different countries, which I'm assuming all have different populations, different tests, different tracing systems. I mean, how did you give some sort of structure to what you were looking at?
What we have focused on are the diagnostic testing systems, which allow countries to know where the virus is and to target resources in the response, and obviously also to identify those patients that need medical treatment and those individuals who need to be isolated. But of course, we're also interested in the wider context of lockdowns and social distancing measures, but mostly we're focusing on testing.
So there are different stages to the testing element. So if we break that down into find, test, trace, isolate and support. First step is find. So how do all of these different countries find people to test? They're looking for people with the virus, and these people may or may not have symptoms. So how do they do that?
We have to identify individuals who have the virus. That is a complicated task. Some of that is about identifying people who come forward with symptoms, and we have to set up a system which enables those people to be rapidly tested. I would call that a passive strategy, having testing centres to be able to allow those people to come forward and be tested. But we think that probably the majority of people that have an infection with coronavirus don't actually have symptoms, and they may not be aware that they're carrying the virus. So we need to find those people through an active strategy that seeks out populations where we think that the virus is likely to be prevalent.
Are there any countries that had a particularly good active strategy?
The active strategy depends on having the capacity to go and screen populations. I think there was a very nice example just the other day with a Chinese city announcing that they had a small number of cases centred on a hospital outbreak, and they're now looking at screening the whole population in a few days.
Is this the Chinese city of Qingdao, where they're testing 9 million people in 5 days?
Absolutely, that's right. So you can imagine that's an enormous number of tests to conduct in a very short space of time. It is certainly conceivable that we would have mass testing in the UK. Boris Johnson has talked about a moonshot programme to develop very large-scale testing.
My personal ideal would be that if everyone gets up in the morning, spits on a test, and then it tells them by the time they've finished their breakfast whether they've got coronavirus, and then they can get on with their day or not.
That is indeed a vision which would be very attractive to many. But of course, there are a lot of technical challenges. What we would expect to see as this pandemic continues to be a major threat is new technologies being developed and tests which are faster, cheaper, but still as reliable, or perhaps even more reliable than RT-PCR testing.
Well, we covered a few of the new potential bits of tech in Inside Science, but your report is looking at basically the summer and what we did in the UK, and I'm wondering, when it comes to technology and actually collecting the samples to test, how did England fare versus the other countries that you looked at?
I think it's very important to emphasise that the way in which we are collecting these samples in the UK is quite different to what we're seeing in other countries.
In what way?
In countries like Germany and South Korea, they have very good systems where they have lots of testing sites where people can go to have their samples taken, and they have lots of local laboratories as well, particularly in Germany. So you have the close connection between the collection of the samples and the testing service, so that it can be quick. But really importantly as well, the samples are collected generally by people who are trained to collect those samples, often with medical backgrounds. And we're not doing that in the UK. Also, what we see in countries like Germany and South Korea are lots of sites that people can go to get tested relatively easily, whereas in the UK, particularly in the early days, there were relatively few sites, and people will remember people having to drive to the next city or drive distances to go to remote sites to be tested. What we're seeing in the UK is individuals being asked to collect their own samples, and this DIY self-swabbing at home is something which is not seen in other countries. In the UK, a lot of sample testing kits are being sent out. People are following, I think, quite complicated instructions to collect this material from the back of their throat and their nostrils and send that off to the lab.
And when you say send it off to the lab, they're going to these lighthouse labs?
Absolutely. We're having to do this because the UK has, over really the past two decades, drastically reduced the capacity of the infection-focused laboratories that we had in this country. What has occurred with the lighthouse laboratories is that entirely new laboratories have been put together in a hurry. When we think about what a laboratory is, it's the systems and the team with the expertise to process samples in a very reliable way. And one of the effects of setting up the lighthouse laboratories outside of the existing NHS laboratory system is that they have not been staffed in the same way, and they have not been connected in the same way. In particular, they've not been connected to the local public health teams, they've not been connected to the IT system that would report the sample results to the general practitioners. What we've created is a fragmented system.
Okay, which is not ideal. And talking of connection, in our story of finding and testing, once you've found your person, they have the virus, you've tested for that, now you need to trace any people that they may have come into contact with. Which countries did well at this stage?
Now, in countries like South Korea and Ireland, they had experience of MERS and SARS in the recent past, so they were concerned to be able to have a rapid response. And South Korea in particular had actually made some legal provisions to be able to get access to personal data from the population to mount emergency disaster responses. So South Korea uses mobile phone signals to identify where people have been in recent days, and they can also use CCTV and data on transactions from people's credit cards and so on to build a detailed picture of where people have been and where they might have made contact with others.
That's clever, but quite invasive on people's privacy.
It is quite invasive, and this has caused controversy because some personal disclosures have been made. But the key thing here is that the South Korean response and this mobile technology, it wasn't an app as such, but mobile phone-based technology, allowed the country to have an automated approach to contact tracing, where people are given these alerts that they are at risk. And that is also supported by manual contact tracing as well. In Germany, they have a well-resourced system of local health authorities that were able to provide the manual contact tracing response. But in countries like Spain, for example, they needed to have state-level response that was still relatively centralised, and they had to hire contact tracers, but they didn't have enough contact tracers, and the system there then was overwhelmed. In countries like Germany and Spain and South Africa, the response has been at the state level. But in the UK, and especially in England, we've got a more centralised response. And this actually has been a problem, because the centralised response in the UK was felt to be necessary because the local teams and that local infrastructure really was not well resourced to begin with. And instead, we rapidly formed NHS Test and Trace, with tens of thousands of individuals recruited to identify those contacts from people with coronavirus, and then to try and get in contact with those people to ask them to self-isolate.
And yet again, just quite a fragmented resource.
So this central system of contact tracing was relatively fragmented in the following ways. There are three tiers when we talk about contact tracing. There are the individuals who talk to those with the virus and identify their contacts, and these individuals will likely have a medical background and be able to talk people through their recent movements and help them to work out who would be the contacts that we need to warn. And then there are the tier of individuals who may not have medical training, but they may simply have experience of customer-facing roles, and they've been recruited to rapidly follow up contacts. But the issue is that the people who are talking to those with coronavirus are recording information into their IT system, and that IT system then is chopping up all of that contact information into little packets and sending that out to the lower tier of call handlers, who are then working in a very fragmented way. They have no contextual information, they just have a number, and they're getting in contact with the individual at the end of that number. They don't know where they live, they don't know what language they speak, and that has been an issue in some areas. They don't know whether that individual will probably already know that they are a contact of a case, because they're in the same household with them. The way that we're fragmenting this information into these little packets means that all of that context is lost. And as a result, people are also being bombarded with phone calls. If you have four individuals in a household, the contact tracing system might be trying to reach each of them.
Finally, the point of tracing the contacts is because you want people who are potentially infectious to isolate and ideally be supported whilst they do this. How long are infectious people isolating for, and what kind of support are they getting? Do we know?
Well, the World Health Organization recommends that after people are identified as having coronavirus, that they self-isolate for the following 13 days. Indeed, they really need to be isolating for 3 days without symptoms before they can be thought of as being safe. In the UK, to begin with, the government advice was that people with symptoms just needed to isolate for 7 days. And then later, of course, this was expanded to 10 days. But actually, the UK government has not been following World Health Organization advice on this. And the other countries that we've studied have accepted the World Health Organization advice on isolation. Of course, implementing that advice in full is another matter. So if we look at Germany, there are states with higher compliance where, when people are asked to isolate, they are talking with those individuals regularly afterwards to make sure that they're following the guidance. And this might involve visits, it might involve phone calls, and that is checking to see whether people are following the guidance and remaining isolated, but also checking on their well-being.
It's funny, I'm 10 days into a quarantine because I was recently out of the country, and I filled in the form and I haven't been outside for 10 days because I'm a goody two-shoes, but I was expecting some sort of follow-up, and there's been nothing.
So Germany's been relatively good, I think, at organising this follow-up, and different countries are doing this in different ways. So, for example, in Spain, people are getting follow-up phone calls for the first few days of their isolation period. And in Ireland, people get text message reminders to stay isolated. And in South Korea, you're required to download an app, and authorities can tell whether you're moving out of your home and send you warning messages. But in the UK, we are really not following up to see whether people are isolating.
So that's isolate. What about support, Michael?
Support is really important because people need to be self-sufficient at home for 2 weeks. And in other countries, we're seeing better financial support, more information, and people also are being given food and brought medicines. And also, in some cases, countries are providing accommodation so that individuals who are unwell can be moved away from vulnerable relatives. And we're seeing this in multiple countries, but the UK is not providing this sort of accommodation.
Each country clearly takes a different approach, and there are going to be countries that do it better and some that do elements worse. But from everything you've been saying, Michael, it feels like the UK has done fairly poorly at every stage of this. What are the biggest things that the UK has done wrong or not done well enough?
It's very easy to criticise the response in the UK, but actually a lot of people have worked very hard to develop the system that we have. One of the key issues has been that although a pandemic is on the national risk register as a major threat to the country, we actually have not had the resilient systems in place that we've needed. So when the virus arrived, we already were in the position where we were going to be on the back foot, and all of these systems and responses that we've had in place have been ad hoc. Quite literally, we have been behind the curve.
Marnie Chesterton talking to Michael Hopkins, and on this